Welcome to Health Tech Central, the podcast that connects you with the wisdom of trailblazers at the intersection of health, care, and technology. 42-ish minutes of entertaining inspiration, actionable insights, and answers to just about everything. Hitchhiking, most definitely allowed. With your host, Mehdi Khaled.
Hello, everyone. Today we have Catherine Cresswell, who is a social scientist with extensive experience in conducting process evaluations of digitally enabled change and improvement programs in health and care. Catherine has over 220 peer-reviewed publications in international academic journals and almost 56 million research grant funding. She's one of those academics who is not really residing in the Death Valley. She's very much active in publishing and publishing content that is really meaningful and actionable. And I'm glad to have her here today with me. Welcome, Catherine. How are you?
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Catherine, just before we start, I'd like to really hear an anecdote from you, that something that happened to you or across your career journey, something that you can share with us that is either lighthearted, funny, or weird. I don't know if you can remember such a moment.
Yeah, I couldn't think of an anecdote that people would understand outside of academia. But I think generally, as a social, I do social science, yeah, or implementation science, because that's what people understand more than social science. But you can basically, my problem is that I'm always perceived as a pessimist, and actually I am a pessimist, not just perceived as a pessimist. So either you're seen as Captain Bringdown, yeah? So you're seeing all the negative things that can go wrong with innovation or technological innovation, and you point them out at the beginning, and that brings everybody down, because the kind of other side of it is, let's just make this work, let's try something new. Or you're seen as either Captain Bringdown or as the solution to all problems, yeah? Where people, you know, ask you for advice on, for example, I've had this so many times before where people have said, how can you help me make others use the system I've developed? And I can't help you do that either. So I'm somewhere in the middle, I think, where you can give some input into advising people of whether something is a good idea. But the problem is, with these things, there's never a recipe for success. Yeah, it's not easy to develop and implement technology in healthcare as a very, very complex setting. And we just have to acknowledge that.
I have to concur with that, because that's almost also the story of my life. Because sometimes you're there and people have high expectations, but sometimes you tell them, look, you can't do that. And so it sets the mood in it to a different tone. And but there still is, despite the, you know, we talk a lot more and there are a lot more publications and there is a lot more information as well related to digital health implementations, initiatives, interventions. But there's still some confusion in some areas where, for example, I still see a lot of confusion between assessment and evaluations. So maybe we can start by you telling us or explaining what's the difference between the two.
Yeah, I think they're merging, actually, to be honest. I think so I focus on evaluation. So what we need to do is we need to understand if and how a technology works. Yeah. And ultimately, the ultimate question we need to answer, if it's safe. Yeah. And also whether it's worth doing. And that a lot of the time is relating to cost effectiveness. So money. I mean, that's what people make decisions based upon ultimately. So yeah, safety and cost effectiveness. And what we do in research or in evaluations, in order to test whether something is safe and effective, we need to first test it in relatively limited settings or in small areas. And we call that a pilot, to test it out and see what things go wrong, what things go right, and trying to adjust them after the pilot. And that can then help us to make a good guess as to how the technology will then perform in other areas. And then that's then when we decide to expand it or scale it, as we would call it. So we implement from one context, test it in one context, and then implement it in another context. But I think the problem is that with context, every context is different, yeah? So our guesses on how a technology will perform in another context based on the experience in one context is not always transferable. And we know, especially with complex technologies, and especially in settings like healthcare, that what works in one context often doesn't work in another context. So there's more likelihood that it doesn't work than it does work. So what we do in evaluation as social scientists is we look at the context and try to understand it, and also look at the processes as to how, for example, how users find the technology. Do they hate it? do they love it, and why? And do they? We find often that users are, for example, they're developing what we call workarounds, where they make the technology look like it works because they are told to use it, so by their superiors, but they're not using it in the ways that was actually intended by the developers, such as doctors, you know, having to fill in fields, compulsory fields, in order to progress on a form, let's say, and they just put in the space bar, they just put in an X, and the stuff that comes then out, it doesn't necessarily make sense. So we look at how users are finding the technology, how they are using it. Based on that, we then make recommendations or hypotheses of how we can change the design of a technology in order to address these issues, or the implementation strategy, because everything that underlies what we do is the assumption that technology and social dimensions are interrelated. Yeah, I forget to say this a lot of the time, because to me it's obvious, but it's not obvious to everybody. Technology will always perform how technology is designed to perform, mostly. People are really, really unpredictable, and what people do with technology is what makes it complex, not just complicated, but also complex to implement technologies. Technologies also have social consequences. They change the way people work. So now we do this over a distance. Yeah, we never worked together before. So that's one example. So it changes interactions and relationships, but also social interactions also have technological consequences, because if we don't like a technology, we don't use it, or we develop workarounds, as I've mentioned earlier. So we can then adjust technological design or implementation strategy to maximize the chances of successful technology adoption and implementation. Now I have some views on what success means as well, because that has, without going on a huge tangent, I think there's you know, success means different things to different people.
Even within the same setting, depending who you're talking to, they will define success in a different way. And so you need to be very careful with that. Settings are very important, and evaluations and assessments will have to be dealt with in a specific setting. But to go back to the evaluations, so we have, let's say, assessments in terms of digital health maturity. And I saw your latest paper that you published. I saw your LinkedIn post about the digital health maturity assessments for hospitals under different cultures and in different geographies. What is your finding there? And we come back to the wider area of system level, but let's start with hospitals and see what your findings in the last paper were.
I think, I mean, it's difficult. It's one of those. So if you have a complex area that you're looking at, yeah, such as digital maturity, different people think it is different things. Some people question whether it is the right thing to measure even. But in order to make decisions on what to do strategically, on what we have at the moment and what we need to do in the future, we need some sort of assessment, some sort of numbers. And digital maturity indexes have tried to get these numbers and to inform decisions of what needs to be done. A lot of that kind of, there's a lot of rhetoric around leveling up. So there's a lot of problems between in the UK and I think elsewhere as well around, you know, you've got these settings that are doing really, really well, that have great technologies that are perfectly used, that have a lot of funding, often, you know, linked to universities. And then you've got settings that are very removed, don't have any funding, and are very low in terms of levels of digital maturity. So there's some sort of agenda of governments internationally to what people call leveling up. Now, in order to measure this, what different countries have done is to look at digital maturity assessments, and they're usually self-reported. Which biases completely what, you know, people can say, what they game, basically. They either say they're too mature or not mature enough in order to get more money. But it gives some sort of indication. What we found is that digital maturity assessments change over time, even within countries, because people think, okay, oh, so our understanding of digital maturity has evolved from technological to what I've just said. You know, ultimately, it's not just technological. People are now understanding, countries are understanding that we need to look beyond technological measurements to include organizational leadership, organizational resources, you know, training.
Skills,
right. All these things. So they evolve over time, but then you can't compare apples and pears. You know, they become different. So temporal assessments are quite difficult. And countries have vastly differing numbers of items on these maturity assessments. So Scotland had a huge number. I can't actually exactly remember what it was, but they also assessed a digital maturity in social care, which none of the others did, for example. So And then you're trying to compare different digital maturity assessments across countries, and then it becomes really, really difficult. So maybe a certain, you know, set of standardized measures, or at least core measures, would be quite helpful to compare and learn from each other as well.
Yeah, and then I find at least probably hospital level is something, but hospital level always is reflected at the national level maturity assessments as well. For having worked with many governments, we've done quite a number of digital health maturity assessments at national levels. And what we observed are two, in terms of bias, are two trends. The first trend is people do not understand the reason for which we are doing the digital health maturity assessment. An assessment is nothing else but a process. You are setting a process in motion by which you want to mature your organization from 1 to 2 to 2 to 3, etc. So you evolve and mature your organizational readiness, and obviously also output in terms of patient outcomes, in terms of costs, in terms of efficiencies, resources, etc. And most people, and I'm saying this again, most people do not understand that at national level. They think maturity assessments are there just so you have a green dot on a map and you look good and that's it. It's something that is evolving in time. It's something that you have to do repetitively and be behind so you can really mature your organization. If you don't measure, you can't manage, and it's a problem. The second point I personally noticed is, as you said, I noticed that kind of Dunning-Kruger effect, that the least mature organization tend to overrate their maturity levels, say, in legislation, policy, compliance, infrastructure, services, application, strategy, investment, whatever, they tend to overrate. And so, and when we go to these instances, hospitals and regions, we see that they are not. So have a look, for example, to the audience, to the Global Digital Health Monitor. Just pick any country randomly. Pick any country from the Global Digital Health Monitor and see if what you see is really what you think it is. So we know, for example, some countries are nowhere near green in terms of policies. Some countries are nowhere near green in terms of cybersecurity and etc. And so this is a little bit, but at least, as you said, it gives us an idea. So all in all, it gives us an idea. We can mix and match. We can see where countries struggle. We can see where others have really made progress. And so coming back to the outputs of digital health interventions, where do you see most projects fail to deliver digital health interventions? Like, of course, when they succeed, it's great. But when they don't, where do you see the most common denominators are?
Yeah, I think it's difficult, isn't it? Maybe just to add one thing to the digital maturity suggestion, thread. I think one thing is that we rely too much on the quantitative evidence. Yeah, we don't take into, and of course I'm saying this because I collect qualitative evidence, and I get that you need numbers to make decisions, but and it does help people make decisions. But our problem is that we have focused on making the measurable meaningful rather than the meaningful measurable. So as a result of that, what we do is we measure things that are easy to measure, and we neglect the stuff that is really, really important.
Mm-hmm.
So sorry, I had to get that in.
That's all right. That's okay. That makes sense, and it's important as well.
So why do digital projects fail? Yeah, I've written a lot on that, and I don't like the term failure at all. Like I say,
Look, a parenthesis on that before you finish. We were on a project. This is a discussion, not an interview, as I said. So before you finish, we were in a project, and one very senior member at the project, in the project steering committee, at least at that level, we did a SWOT analysis, and the guy said, "My boss doesn't like to see weaknesses and threats. Please take them out."
No, they, I would be like, that's, yeah, they'd kick me out of this project. Because I think I, what's helped a lot of students in the past is to do something called a pre-mortem. Yeah. You know, you might know this from the management kind of background.
Yep. Yep.
So thinking about what could go wrong can really, really help you to address in advance, to help you to address the risks. But I think, okay, so trying to answer the question, saying that I don't like the term failure. I'm all about lessons, learning lessons. And I think is the only mistake, I keep telling my children, the only mistake is a lesson not learned. So if we don't know, then we don't know. So we just have to be learning the lessons. And then nothing can fail, actually. And that's quite liberating. I think too much enthusiasm in digital health technology is dangerous, especially with new technologies that are not proven to work and not evaluated properly. And I get that, like, especially with the Gen AI kind of rhetoric at the moment, sometimes it's too risky not to deploy something that can bring a lot of benefit. But still, I think too much enthusiasm is dangerous. I think there's this issue around many different stakeholder agendas that may be conflicting. We somehow need to align, yeah, and make compromises. And I'm quoting Robin Williams, my mentor here. That might need to involve picking the least worst option for some. And I think it's about, you know, learning the lessons or thinking about it in terms of tensions and trade-offs that we have to navigate. Yeah. So for example, if we are looking at efficiency measurements that are big, you know, everywhere, productivity and efficiency is something that we're all pressed to do in health and care. But a lot of the time, that means more work, more pressure. Organizational efficiency might mean more work and pressure on healthcare professionals. Yeah. So there's a disconnect between what is happening on the healthcare professional level versus the organizational level. Organizational efficiency does not equal individual efficiency as a healthcare provider, because a lot of the time that's to do with structured data entry, you know, filling in more forms that can then be used for secondary uses of data that can really help to make the organization vastly more efficient, but that might destroy you and to lead to burnout as a healthcare professional. So I can go on, shall I? The biggest problems are, I think, lack of usability. I've said this again and again. If the system is not used, then it has failed. You don't want the holy grail is not to develop a system and show that it might work. The holy grail is to develop a system that is used. And there's this, you mentioned the valley of death earlier. There's a graveyard of existing systems. But the problem is that the developers are so enthusiastic, getting me back to my first point, they're so enthusiastic. And I understand it, you know, when you're developing something and it's got great potential, but you're only looking at it from one viewpoint, you know, and you're thinking you finished when you've showed a proof of concept. But that's not enough. And I don't blame them, but a lot of the time developers don't understand what the context of use look like. So I think, yeah, we need to work with developers more. Developers need to work with us more to bridge that gap between context of use and technological features. As a rule of thumb, the reasons for failure always lie in technological factors. Always the same: usability, interoperability. It's always the same stuff. It doesn't matter what technology it is. Adoption. You know, like I said, people probably don't find a technology useful, or they find that it interferes with their existing work practices, or it takes time away from patients. Organizational. So, for example, the organization might have different priorities. There might not be an alignment with the technology and existing business models. And the last one is health system factors. So, if a technology is not a national priority and organizations don't have to, let's say, report on certain outcome metrics that are potentially in conflict with a technology, then, you know, it just won't be used at the organizational level. So, to conclude, it's always, why do systems fail? It's always because of technology factors, socio-organizational factors, and health system factors.
Yeah, I'd add as well that the siloed nature of healthcare, because, you know, clinicians work as clinicians, IT people work as IT people. It's coming together now when we see a lot more clinicians coming across the aisle and going to the other side and vice versa. But there is a lot more collaboration now. And I think many countries have understood that. And there is a lot less silos than there used to be. But I think I've noticed in my experience, at least, that if any digital health endeavor or technology, health technology endeavor is driven by technologists only without this balance in working with clinicians. And I'm saying clinicians can be doctors, nurses, paramedics, what have you, or all clinicians, then it tends to fail because there is a mismatch between the problem definition that can only be defined by those who are using the system and the solution provided, which lacks then visibility and understanding of the real problem. And so there is a mismatch in the solution implementation that also can be seen as a lack of feasibility, user friendliness, etc. So we've seen this a lot before in the early 2000s. We've seen this less now. But then I guess the other part of me that says at system level that really makes a technology, even if it's great and it's a great solution, and it's the right solution that is needed for the right problem at the right time, sometimes policy lag behind. The policies are sometimes really enablers. And so remember, medicine do no harm, right? So sometimes when we've seen this a lot during COVID, countries who do not have any word written in that chart called telemedicine policy, all of a sudden overnight started deploying telemedicine platforms. And that's a problem. Why? The rules of engagement are not really written. How do you make sure you don't, how do you catch near misses in telemedicine if you don't write them down? How do you deal with a pediatric patient, underage patient on the other side of the screen? How do you do the handshake? How do you do? So many things can go wrong. And this is a problem still for many countries who still do not have telemedicine policies. Exactly. So you can have the right technology, but then the policy is back and you end up doing things that are unintended, like I said. And so I think policies are an increasingly important area of enablement, if you will. The problem with policies, it's not a sexy topic. Nobody wants to talk about it. It's just writing papers and rules and regulations, and being compliant is seen as policying on someone. But I don't know, what's your take on that? I see policies as a major, major foundation for the success and impact of digital health interventions as much as other things like interoperability standards, skills, governance, etc. What's your experience in that domain?
So I don't know. It's a slow moving beast, isn't it? And it's, so there's always this kind of rhetoric around, you know, innovation and regulation inhibit each other. Although I've recently heard, and I think I agree with it, that good regulation doesn't necessarily inhibit innovation at all. It just has
Absolutely.
To be good. I'm almost thinking the policy making, the policy agenda is being hijacked a lot of the time by exactly what I said was dangerous around, you know, in relation to digital. And it's that enthusiasm, and it's that, oh, wouldn't it be a great idea if we, going back to the national program, if we put electronic health records everywhere across the nation that are interoperable? And yeah, it sounds like a good idea, yeah, at the face of it. But actually, you probably should ask some people who've tried to do this or who've really thought about it, you know, for their opinion on it first before you try the next new thing. There's no learning in policy making whatsoever. I've done 3 national evaluations of national programs, and very limited to no learning has been taken through, even though we said the same problems keep coming up and up and up. And that is because there's no stability in leadership. There's you know, what we had during the AI Lab evaluation, we had 7 health ministers, and every health minister wants to do, you know, I think did you mention sexy stuff? Every health minister wants to have the next announcement and do something sexy. And
yeah,
it's not infrastructure, they, you know, because that's too boring. But actually, that's what
right.
we need. It's always
right.
innovative stuff. It's not the stuff that scaling the stuff that works, unfortunately.
Yeah, but also, I think you're right. And I think I have the same perception of the problematic at political level, because, you know, a politician, health minister or health minister minus one, they're always on the side of, okay, we built a new hospital with 300 beds, and they will be in denial if, you know, all of a sudden we have to merge 2 hospitals, which means we have to close 1 of the 2. And then go public and announce that. It's like, how can you close a hospital? Well, you know, modern healthcare systems are reducing the number of beds because care at home and self-care are the next big thing. It's not about more beds. It's about you know, efficient healthcare systems and taking care of your population, more prevention, more things like that. And so I think that's the future, and that's a trend that's actually demonstrated, that sustainable healthcare systems will have to go that way. There is no way you can still keep building hospitals and expect your healthcare system to deliver better results. It's like building more highways, right? You'll have more cars anyway. So the answer is public transport and not more highways. It's exactly the same for healthcare systems. And I think the easiest thing to do and copy are policies, because most, if not all, policies in healthcare and digital health are public domain. You can go to any ministry's website and download the thing and then adapt and adopt. We've done the same thing, by the way, for Saudi Arabia, when we've written the telemedicine policy for the country in 2018 or 19, I don't remember. We've taken benchmarks. We went to Canada. Canada has one of the best telemedicine policies, and because they're very mature, they have it like segregated in different specialties and different domains, and it's great. So why don't you go there and then be inspired by that and just rewrite it? So it's not a big deal. So it's a slow moving beast, because it has to move through the instances of the government and get approvals, and sometimes people don't understand it and block it. But it has, to me, policies still have the highest impact if they're done right. And if they're not done, they can have a negative impact as well. But I think policies is to me a domain that needs a little bit more attention. And I'm preaching for that. Policies and governance are, to me, the biggest things.
I agree. I mean, so what we've tried to do is, you know, people probably don't know what formative evaluations are, but that's how we try to impact policies. So as an academic, you get judged on impact. Yeah. What difference does your work make to the world? And that's what I enjoy doing most, actually, as well. But what we've done in these big national program evaluations is we have worked with policymakers who've commissioned us to identify and help to address emerging risks. Yeah. So for example, trying to help to develop strategy and policy that has the maximum chances of being, you know, of being successful. But ultimately, what policymakers want is, I suppose, or what they should want anyway, is maximizing the chances of successful technology adoption and scaling in the end. Yeah. So that's been quite good, actually. When you have a policymaker that wants to listen to you and works with you, then it can be quite nice and quite satisfying, which was the case in the AI Lab evaluation recently, and also in the Global Digital Exemplar evaluation we've done, because it can be a win-win. Yeah. Policymakers get an insight as to what is actually happening on the ground. We've done this before. We, as academics, we can help you to learn from history and try, you know, we know the literature, we know what is likely to work and what isn't likely to work. But in order to get there, you need to have a relatively trusted relationship, which takes decades to develop sometimes, and policymakers absolutely move very quickly.
Yeah, absolutely right. We've done that paper with the AI Club, I guess, 2 years ago in 2023, was published and presented to the UN General Assembly by Rachel. And we've recommended some things with regards to evaluations and assessments of AI in healthcare. And now we've seen that I think the European Union retracted one of the chapters, I think the most important one, which is basically the liability of systems versus, so if you are a patient or if you are a user and you've been harmed by AI, you basically have no rights anymore. So you can't claim your rights because this has been withdrawn all of a sudden. I don't know if you've heard of that, but I find it quite intriguing. Why would someone do that? And, you know, you just upend the rights of any individual, any citizen in the EU, if harmed by any AI application or instance. You just deny the right for claiming any rights for whatever damages or harm or what have you. So that's interesting, in talking about policies, how people deal with it. I don't know if it was done under pressure or, you know, the political context right now is not the most, you know, brilliant in human history, but, you know, I don't know what the context of that is, but I found it quite interesting that to, you know, withdraw already, you know, passed on laws and policies in that regard. You've worked extensively with the NHS, and can we talk a little bit about NICE? Have you worked with NICE and in their evaluations of digital health interventions, or have you had any interactions with them?
So we've looked at regulation in relation to the AI Lab. I'm not the expert to talk to, but my kind of high level view is that at NICE level, we just basically need to understand when evidence is enough, like when evidence is enough to deploy. So it's quite difficult to make those decisions. And I don't envy NICE to have to make those decisions. In some instances now, especially now AI is developing so fast and we just can't keep up with evidence, it can be risky not to deploy. And I know randomized controlled trials are the golden, what's it called? The golden, you know, that's what we all should do. Gold standard, that's it. But they're really expensive and they're really long. So what I have argued for are much better, good enough, agile, quick approaches to evaluation. And we have argued that in our paper as well. And I think they need to be good enough and they shouldn't seek, as many academics do a lot of the time, to give the perfect answer, because it's going to be too late if it's perfect. But we can make a good guess, and a lot of the time that's probably good enough to make a reasonable impact onto practice. But I think it's now increasingly understood that we need to assess, well, that's what we've done in the AI lab evaluation. We've been looking at impact, and you mentioned it earlier, the impact is mainly the holy grail, again, is on patient outcomes, although that's super hard to measure. So we use proxies such as, you know, healthcare practitioner performance, like time saved or whatever. Although that doesn't actually tell us very much in terms of impact, because it depends what people do with that time, you know.
But
overall, I think we need to look at impact, try. You know, even if it's a proxy, value to make decisions on cost effectiveness and the processes. That's what we should be looking at.
Yeah, WHO has published a digital health strategy framework that articulates more or less the same domains articulated here in Digital Health Monitor. What I'm seeing is, even though the domains are the same, when you go to a country, the way they deal with them is very different. So, and the perception of the one or the other area can be very different. So governance and leadership are, you know, when you have a top-down government, governance and leadership is not a question, because the decisions are made anyway. So why do we need governance? And so we've seen a lot of problems in that aspect too. But then, you know, honestly, I have an answer. I don't even have a question for that. But I'm seeing these discrepancies and a lot of money poured into buying technologies. But it's almost as if we're, by design, implementing them the wrong way. So I don't know what the answer to that particular behavior is. Is it a FOMO? Is it a fear of missing out? Let's buy AI because tomorrow there will be no AI on the market anymore. It's a very funny behavior that I find, far from being responsible to do something like that. And I'm talking like really, really from the field. So even though we advise against doing something, people just do what they want to do, because, you know, If you tell a non-smoker to quit smoking, you can tell him, right? Yeah. It's exactly, we're seeing the same behavior, but it's at national level. We're talking taxpayers' money, and that's something that is a source of frustration sometimes, because you advise, you give the best advice you can give, and you do the best strategy you can write. But then the execution is like, all right, thank you very much. We'll do what we think is right.
Yep.
So.
But, you know, Mandy, if you take it down, I agree. That's absolutely what I've experienced. But it's, you know, people need to learn by experience, I think. It's like kids, you know. I can tell my kid not to touch the hob, you know. It's going to burn them. But, you know, I think it's like that. And when you're so excited by something, I get it. You know, it is really exciting. Then and also it's linked to economic objectives. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of money in these things and a lot of glory in these things. But what we found, so I think learning and lack of willingness and openness to learn, to come back to that, I think that's really, really important. But the thing is, it's easier to learn from personal experience. So not what I always use in my talks is that knowledge sticks to people and it sticks to context. So you, and that's why it's so a way to circulate knowledge is to put people from the outside in and help you, guide you through it. Or it's also developing, you know, communities of practice so people can learn from each other. That can also help. But it's very, very difficult.
Very, very powerful, but very difficult to set up.
Yes, yes. But what we also know is that learning through documents, like toolkits you mentioned, it's very limited. It's a lot of work to do. And I think it's okay. But we found in the GDE work that we've done, they've done a huge number of blueprints, and I think that can be quite helpful. But they're produced in a certain context at a certain part in time. People just use these documents to get in touch with the people who'd authored them and call them up. You know, so yeah, toolkit can
be good,
but not
topic.
If it takes you years to produce.
What would be your straight arrow advice to, you know, decision makers at system level or even at hospital level in terms of assessment evaluations, utilization of digital health initiatives and implementations? What would be your 1, 2, 3 points of advice to them?
So 1, 2, 3. I might just have 2. I think evaluation. You have to evaluate. Of course, I'm going to say that because I evaluate. But evaluation means that it also means that you can is a mean to engage stakeholders, and it's a mean to learn from experience. So evaluate. 1, listen to people who've done it before. You know, coming back to our previous point, yeah, and that can be experts internally and externally. Like you mentioned, like you said, we're not looking outwards. Other countries might have done it or might have tried it and failed. Even better, because then we don't have to try it. You know, then we can be a good follower rather than the leader. You know, that's what a Norwegian the Norwegian approach is. It's great to be a great follower. It's a perfect opportunity. So evaluate, listen to experience, and look outwards, and baseline. We never baseline because we get taken away by all the enthusiasm, and then we forget to measure what was in place before the technology, and then we can't evidence any progress.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. That's absolutely great to hear. And baselining is really the thing that I haven't seen much in the last 25 years. Not many people do baselining. And when they do it, they don't do it right, and they do it quickly because they needed to. And it's a domain where a lot of impact can be done if you do it right. And so you can measure impact after that. If you don't, then what to do and how to know? Point of departure.
What
Catherine, thank you so very much for being with me. Thank
You're
you.
Welcome. Pleasure. Thank you.
This has been Health Tech Central. We hope you enjoyed the show. Please don't forget to subscribe on your preferred podcast channel and give us a rating or review. Finally, you can check out our news on healthtechcentral.io and inspire us with your feedback. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next exciting episode of Health Tech Central.